This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiye Suhib in Washington, and here is what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
We made one fundamental problem or challenge for the state of throwing away our currency in 2009.
Yes.
We're supposed to keep it. Yes, you're supposed to drag through, live with others.
That was John Mangudya, governor of the Reserve Bank of Zimbabwe, on the continued weakness of the reintroduced local currency that keeps falling against the U.S. dollar. Details coming up. Also, the U.S. has accused Tunisia's president of undermining the country's democratic institutions. These stories and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. But first, our top story. The head of the African Union Senegalese President Macky Sall has met President Vladimir Putin in the southwestern Russian city of Sochi on Friday. The visit, according to Sall's office, is aimed at freeing up stocks of cereals and fertilizers, the blockage of which particularly affects African countries, along with easing the Ukraine conflict. The war in Ukraine has sent the cost of fuel, grain and fertilizers skyrocketing around the globe, which is being acutely felt in African nations. Both Ukraine and Russia are major suppliers of wheat and other cereals to Africa, while Russia is a key producer of fertilizer. Tarek Wahibi is the spokesman for the International Committee of the Red Cross, Sahel region. VOA's Douglas Mpuga reached him in Niger by phone and began by asking him how serious a problem the grain blockade was to Africa.
It's important to understand how big this crisis is globally. Even before the crisis in Ukraine, Africa was facing a major food crisis. More than 346 million people are food insecure right now on the continent. That's one in four people. Now, when the Ukraine crisis came along, this added a very big layer of complications to things. Food prices skyrocketed. According to the UN Food Index, the prices are at their highest in 60 years. So prices of wheat, for example, are up by 43%. Ukraine and Russia were both the main exporters of wheat and cereals to the world, and Africa is also extremely affected by that. So what we are seeing is a food crisis that is being severely aggravated by the conflict in Ukraine. For example, in places in West Africa, we have seen the prices of wheat and food skyrocket by some places by 150% even. The situation is really dangerous at the moment.
How has this one impacted organizations like yours in making sure that Africans they get the food they need?
Well, there are both direct and indirect implications. So for the International Committee of the Red Cross, for example, we are a highly mobile organization. So we have a fleet of cars and aircraft that we use in order to get to populations in need. Fuel prices and energy prices, for example, have risen by more than 50%. At the same time, our ability to procure food products is also affected because food prices are up by an average of 20%. At the same time, more people are becoming in need. So what is happening is our financing, so our ability to buy food products is becoming less and less strong. So we're having to adapt ourselves. We are extending our budgets in order to scale up our response throughout the continent. We are having to change the sources of our food items. We are trying to substitute certain items, for example, wheat to millet and sorghum that is locally produced in West Africa. We are having to change the way our logistics are being done. So we are having to adapt very quickly to the situation.
These countries involved in this conflict are major producers, as you mentioned, of crops like wheat. And nobody knows when the conflict might end. So what do you think should be the way to resolve this food crisis?
Right now, we know that there are certain sanctions that are, for example, being put in place that affect these countries' ability to export wheat. what we are calling on is for world leaders to take into consideration that these things have effects on places around the world where people are becoming food insecure.
And that was Tarika Wahibi, spokesperson for the International Committee of the Red Cross. He was talking to VOA's Douglas Apuga from Niger. 4 forces in Kenya yesterday killed 4 people during a demonstration against the threats posed by wildlife. Mashuru Town Police Chief Charles Chipengo said the protesters clashed with security forces, resulting in the fatal shootings. Kajiado County Governor Joseph Ole Lenku called on police to avoid using excessive force and also urged Kenyan wildlife authorities to keep their animals away from people. Thursday's demonstration blocked the Nairobi-Mombasa highway for hours as protesters placed rocks and burning tires on the road, leading police to intervene. Residents have repeatedly called on the Kenyan Wildlife Service to find a solution to the conflicts between people and animals, with farmers upset that elephants destroy their crops and at times kill people. Protesters held signs saying schools have been closed because of elephants in the area. Some senior economists in Harare say the reintroduced Zimbabwean dollar has failed to live up to expectations and faces collapse possibly by the end of the month. They say the market and the public have widely rejected it, mirroring the end of the old Zim dollar in 2009. From Harare, reporter Kuzai Zanawashi has more.
Local media have quoted economics professors Anthony Hawkins and Gift Mugano as suggesting the local currency is in its final days. This comes as the Zimbabwean dollar, battered by the rising cost of living and runaway inflation, has dramatically lost value against the US currency. Most of the employed earn in the local currency, so their income and confidence in the Zimbabwean dollar is eroded every month. Mugano is a professor of economics with a PhD from Nelson Mandela Metropolitan University in South Africa. He is an independent analyst.
As a person and as an economist, I believe that there's no country which can function competitively without its own currency. We need our own currency. But what we need vis-a-vis the reality on the ground are two different things.
When the Zimbabwean dollar was reintroduced in 2016, it was meant to solve the issue of change in transactions. When the local currency was introduced, it traded at par with the US dollar, but it has failed to keep up with the US dollar. Libad Muzavazi is employed in the retail sector and earns in the local currency.
The challenge we are having is that the exchange rate is really going up, yet our salaries are still stagnant. Today's exchange rate is around 500 Zim dollars against the US dollar. About a month ago, it was around 420 against the US dollar. Yet my salary still remains the same.
Mugano explains why he thinks the Zimbabwean dollar won't be around much longer.
So why I'm skeptical about the performance of our local currency is because it's not backed by production. In economics, we say the strength of the currency is reflected in its productive capacity. We don't have a clear plan which is aimed at advancing our national production.
The state of the local currency has always been an area of debate between the government and its critics. Authorities have often expressed optimism, at least in public. In a break from the government's position, John Mangujwa, governor of the Reserve Bank of Zimbabwe, recently expressed regret over the exclusive use of the US dollar in Zimbabwe. The economy had relied on the US dollar for years after the old Zimbabwe dollar died a painful death amid hyperinflation, wiping out much of people's savings and pensions. Memories of those losses were still fresh when the government brought back the local dollar, putting it at a disadvantage from the start.
I've never said this in public. We made one fundamental problem or challenge or mistake in the country of throwing away our currency in 2009.
Yes.
We're supposed to keep it, we're supposed to drag through, live with others.
He gives the example of Mozambique, Zambia, and Russia, which didn't abandon their currencies during economic depressions. Mugano proposes setting up a national working group with the goal of ramping up the country's production, but the government has shown no interest in the proposal. The government still supports the local currency, but has been forced to strike a balance with its need for foreign currency. To ease growing calls for US dollar salaries, the government introduced a US dollar component to civil servant salaries. Duty for importing goods and cars was paid exclusively in US dollars, but now, for cars, half of it can be paid in local currency. Economists warn that there needs to be fiscal discipline, and the basics such as production need to be right for the local currency to have a fighting chance. As it stands, Zimbabwe's production sector is subdued, hence rendering the country a net importer, driving demand for US dollar. For VOA, this is Kudzai Zvinavashe from Harare.
The U.S. yesterday accused Tunisia's President Kais Saied of undermining his country's democratic institutions after he fired dozens of judges amid a raft of measures that appeared designed to consolidate one-man rule. Saied, who has also replaced the Independent Electoral Commission and said he will introduce a new constitution this month, accused the judges of corruption and protecting terrorists in a televised address. U.S. State Department spokesperson Ned Price said the purge was part of an alarming pattern of steps that have undermined Tunisia's independent democratic institutions. He added that the U.S. continues to urge the Tunisian government to pursue an inclusive and transparent reform process with input from civil society and diverse political voices to strengthen the legitimacy of reform efforts. Ethiopian Deputy Prime Minister and Minister of Foreign Affairs Demeke Mekonnen recently told his country's parliament that Sudanese forces occupied Ethiopian land in the Al-Fashqa area in late 2020. He said Addis Ababa seeks to recover the territory through dialogue. A Sudanese foreign ministry called the claim false and misleading and in violation of treaties signed between the two countries. Cameron Hudson, a senior associate at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, discussed the tension between the two African neighbors with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi.
Well, we've already seen some low-level fighting between the two countries around Fashaga since the Sudanese first started to retake it. So the fact that there is a great deal of tension in that area, and frankly, the fact that both governments in Ethiopia and Sudan are struggling with their own internal weaknesses right now, I think that the situation Fashqa bears a very close watching, because either side could try to use instability there to their own advantage domestically.
Mekonnen's accusations against Sudan were not limited to the border dispute, as he also accused Khartoum of harboring terrorists in reference to the Tigrayan People's Liberation Front fighters. He said that Sudan had opened its lands to the rebels to launch attacks on the Ethiopian federal forces. What do you make of that?
Well, I think that probably goes too far. We know certainly that Sudan has opened up its border area to Tigrayan refugees leaving Ethiopia who have been ethnically cleansed over the course of the war going on 2 years now. And so they've been providing, we know, humanitarian assistance through an international effort there along the border. There has been no evidence, however, that I have seen to substantiate the claims by the Ethiopian government that refugee camps inside Sudan are being used as either areas of recruitment for Tigrayan fighters or by the Sudanese to support militarily Tigrayans who may be going back into Ethiopia to fight. Those allegations have been around for some time, but really no proof to back them up.
Another source of tension, talks held under the auspices of the African Union since June 2020 have failed to reach an agreement between Egypt, Sudan, and Ethiopia over the GERD. The dispute over the dam is likely to escalate, with Ethiopia intending to fill its reservoir for the third time in the rainy season that begins in June, despite the opposition of Egypt and Sudan to its unilateral decisions. Is escalation is feasible here too?
Yes, I believe it is. This has been a long festering dispute between primarily Egypt and Ethiopia, with Sudan going back and forth in allegiances between these two much larger neighbors. And so I do think that there's a real concern right now that with the third filling, you could see both an increase in bellicose rhetoric by all sides, but potentially even military action. Egypt has been accused of using Sudan as a proxy force to increase military tensions with Ethiopia. I think we could continue to see that as we see Sudan and its military become to rely very heavily on Egypt and its military as Sudan sorts out its internal instability. So it's a very complicated situation right now.
That was Cameron Hudson, a senior associate at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, speaking with VOA's Mohamed Al-Shenawi. The two countries have disputed the fertile Al-Fashqa region for more than a century. Under a 2007 agreement, people from both nations were allowed to farm while the two governments formally demarcated the border. You're listening to African News Tonight. I'm Yeheyes Wuhib in Washington. Please note we have moved our programs from voanews.com to voaafrica.com. There you will find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. Find us on voaafrica.com. Journalists play an important role providing information and uncovering corruption in a democracy. But in Zambia, most journalists, especially in the private media, are paid low salaries ranging from $50 to $100 per month. That's far below the minimum wage of $150 for general workers. Katie Short reports from Lusaka.
The media has grown at a very fast pace in Zambia, with more than 40 commercial TV stations and 120 radio stations, including community radio outlets. They are also an important means for discussing local issues. While this has opened up job opportunities for journalists, their salaries remain very low and fall short of standards suggested by the International Labour Organization. Ennis Chanda is a print journalist with more than 20 years work experience.
I think Zambian journalists generally are hardworking. When you look at their input and compare to their revenue, there's a very sharp contradiction in that they put in more, yet get paid very little. But when you look at most of the institutions they work for, the owners of those institutions live luxurious lives by Zambian standards. So there is an element of greed among most employers. They do not want to pay what is acceptable in the environment.
The Zambia Media Association says it is working very closely with the government to improve the welfare of journalists. It is also worried about the low representation of female journalists in higher-paying decision-making jobs in newsrooms. In addition, female journalists are paid lower salaries than their male counterparts, despite having same qualifications. Mwazi Sakala is the secretary of the Zambia Media Women Association.
Many journalists still face difficulties in guaranteeing decent wages. As is the case in any sector, women are disproportionately affected by poor conditions of service. Most media houses will be employing journalists on a part-time basis or voluntary basis owing to the financial difficulties that these media houses are facing.
Recently, the Zambian government's chief spokesperson, Chushi Kasanda, said the poor working conditions of service for journalists cannot be allowed to continue. Kasanda has since called for submissions from journalist associations and unions for parliament to set up a minimum wage for journalists. I'm Kathy Short for VOA News in Lusaka, Zambia.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The vast majority of people in the Western Hemisphere believe democracy remains the best form of government, observed Secretary of State Antony Blinken in a speech to the Conference on the Americas. Yet, we can't take the democratic character of this region for granted, warned Secretary Blinken. It's not inevitable. It depends fundamentally on people's continued belief that they can improve the system from within. A key to building people's faith in democracy is to avoid falling into political blocks of left and right, liberal and conservative, and instead focus on what brings us together as democracies, said Secretary Blinken.
That means recognizing our shared interest in strengthening the pillars of our fellow free and open societies, like the rule of law, like respect for human rights, like free and fair elections, a vibrant independent press.
On the economic front, open markets and free trade must create broader-based opportunity and improve conditions of workers across the hemisphere. Ways to do this include eliminating the barriers that keep small businesses from joining the formal economy, combating the corruption that robs the resources and energy of innovators and communities alike, and broadening access to emerging technologies. Western Hemisphere nations also need to build greater regional resilience to make the hemisphere less vulnerable to supply chain disruptions, one of the most hard-earned lessons of the pandemic. Finally, even as we stay focused on strengthening democracies from within, warned Secretary Blinken, we need a shared approach to autocracies in the region.
This includes continuing to support the individuals and groups in closed countries who are fighting so bravely to advance human rights and democracy, as we've done for decades. We have a responsibility also to speak up and speak out collectively when we see governments weakening democracy at home, clamping down on the free press, threatening political opponents, undermining the independence of the courts.
I'm confident that if we embrace what unites us as democracies rather than what divides us, we will not only strengthen our individual democracies, we will do better at what is our number one responsibility, and that is delivering on the fundamental needs and the fundamental hopes of all the peoples in this hemisphere.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiyes Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, and our engineer, Justin Twait, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for an hour of awesome African music. Wake up, dance this music. Like to stay on top of new music trends, breakout artists, new releases? Maybe you just love the classic styles and artists of the past. Or simply the sound and feel of a good beat. Whatever your pleasure, you can get it every week right here on Music Time in Africa.
VOA brings you the best in African music on the African beat. African Beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music, from bobo music to hip life, bonga flavor to soukous, Afrobeat to ndombolo and makossa to kwaito. The African Beat on VOA has it all. And it's happening right here, Mondays through Fridays at 09:05.